Well, it is time to begin. We are studying Hebrews, and we are towards the end of the fourth chapter, and then we're going to go mostly through chapter 5 this morning. So let's begin with a word of prayer and get started in chapter 4. Heavenly Father, thank you for letting us study your word. Thank you for the things that we can learn about your son, Jesus. Thank you for the forgiveness of sins that we have because of his sacrifice. Thank you for your grace and your mercy. Thank you for your love. Thank you for being merciful to us when we continually go astray and keep struggling with sins, struggling with the weaknesses that we face. Please help us to be stronger. Please strengthen us and help us to turn to you in our challenges. Please help us to learn and to grow from this study. It's in your son's name we pray. Amen. Okay, so we are in chapter 4 here, and just to give us a quick little review to get us to where we were, in chapter 1, we talked about Jesus as the great exalted Son of God. In chapter 1, he referred to Jesus exclusively as the Son. And he talked about him reigning and the exalted reign that he has today. But then in chapter 2, he took us all the way down to Jesus on earth. And he talked about Jesus becoming a human and being just like us, facing all of the same challenges of suffering and everything that we face. And because of that, he's able to help us, was the idea. And then, in the next chapter, in chapter 3, he talked about Jesus being faithful. And the way the writer describes this is by comparing him to Moses and talking about how Jesus was the head of this house as Moses was a servant in a house. And the house that he's talking about is God's people, us. We are God's house. And Jesus is faithful in that house. And that led him into the end of that section was about us remaining faithful. We're God's house if we remain faithful. And for that section, he compared us to the Israelites as they went into the promised land. And he talked about how here are the Israelites right on the brink of the promised land. God is telling them about his promised rest that he's going to give them. And they're not faithful. And because of that, they miss out on that great promised rest. And so then for us today, we have a chance to enter that same rest. We can be with God and enjoy that rest. So there's this, it's a wonderful, happy message. But then he turns it on a negative side. You notice in this picture, we've got all these dead people over on the left, and over on the right, there's some more dead people. And that's kind of characterizes this passage here. It talks about all these people who fell in the wilderness because of their unbelief. And then he ends that passage with, God's word is like a sword. It pierces you. It pierces right to your heart. And then he ends that passage with this warning of God sees what's in our heart. He knows whether we're being faithful or not. He knows our every thought, and he will judge us. And that's how he ends that section. It's in the middle it's happy, but at the end it's this warning. God knows what's in our heart, and he's going to judge us for that. Well, if you were the readers here, how would you react to that? Let's try to put ourselves in the mindset of these readers. Here they are, these Jews who became Christians, and then things got difficult, and so now they're thinking of quitting. They're getting discouraged in their walk here. So the question is that I want us to try to think through. As a Jew, what would be your solution to this problem? This idea of God knows everything in your heart, and he's going to judge you. What was the Jewish solution to that dilemma? Any thoughts on that?
Make a sacrifice.
Make a sacrifice. Very good. Yes, in the old law, if when we have sins, you take your animal and you go sacrifice it, and that takes care of those sins. Yes? And who was it that typically made those sacrifices? The priests. And so the priests played this very important role for the people. We have sins. We're going to be judged by God. The only solution is to take our animal and have the priest sacrifice it for us so that we can have that forgiveness. Now, there was one day that was the most important day of all for this, and that was the Day of Atonement, when the high priest would go and he would take blood and he would offer that blood before God, and that would be the atonement for the whole nation and all of their sins. And so, when they think of this problem of, we are guilty, we deserve judgment, the Jewish solution was, that's why we have a high priest. That's why we have someone who can go before God and offer that blood so that it's all taken care of. That's the solution to this problem. And so the Hebrew writer is going to follow right along with that train of thought. And he's going to say, just like how you had a high priest before, you have a high priest now. Except it's going to be a whole lot better. And so that takes us into today's class. Here at the end of chapter 4 and beginning chapter 5, we have this section of Jesus is our high priest. And he's going to talk about how Jesus is the kind of priest who can deal gently with us. He can take care of us. He knows what we're going through. And so the application for this is going to be draw near to that throne of grace. And we're going to talk about what that means. So I want to start by looking at what is a high priest. For the Jews that he was writing to, they understood perfectly well what a high priest was. They were very familiar with this concept. But for us, we don't have a high priest today. We know a little bit about high priests from what we read in the Bible, but we're definitely not as familiar with that concept as they were back then. So let's just spend a few minutes talking through what it means to be a high priest. What does a high priest do? Well, here's the illustration. We have God here, and then we have all of the humanity. So here are the Israelites down here, and they have a problem, and their problem is sin. The Israelites have all sinned. They've done things that are wrong. So what are they going to do about this issue? Well, the way that God set it up for them is that there would be one man appointed among them who was the high priest. And this one man would go forward, go before God on behalf of the people. Now, he had the same problem as all the other people. He was sinful as well, which is kind of an interesting thing that here the sinful guy is going before God. But that was the way it was. So here, he's sinful, they're sinful, but he is the one man who's chosen to go before God in a sort of in place of all the people. He goes before God, and he represents the people to God. And as he goes before God, he offers a sacrifice. It's that Day of Atonement. He sprinkles that blood in God's presence. And then God forgives them. So that one man goes forward, he offers that sacrifice, and God forgives all the people. Now, what makes the high priest so important is you think about, here are all these sinful people. If that high priest doesn't do his job, they're in trouble. Their salvation depends, in a way, on this high priest. Having a high priest who's going to faithfully go before God and offer that sacrifice so they can all be forgiven. It's very different than the concept that we have today. We don't think of depending on one man in that kind of sense. But here, everything depended on this one guy to go before God that once a year and offer that blood so that they could be forgiven. The high priest was very, very important for them in the Jewish law. So, let's read chapter 4, verse 14 is where we're going to begin. He says in verse 14, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. So he opens up this section by saying, we have a great high priest. Jesus is the high priest that's greater than any other high priest who's ever lived. And then he's going to go through the rest of this section and explain why that is the case. Why Jesus is a high priest and why he is a greater high priest than any high priest they've ever known in the past. Now, he spent this book getting himself ready for this argument. This idea of Jesus being the high priest is going to be the bulk of the book of Hebrews, the largest section of the book of his arguments about Jesus are going to be about Jesus being a high priest. And when we look back at what we've studied so far, he's actually been getting himself ready for this point. He's twice now, he's referenced Jesus as the high priest, over in chapter 2 and in chapter 3. Let me turn back there. In Hebrews chapter 2, verse 17, he says, therefore he had to be made like his brethren in all things so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God to make petition for the sins of the people. And then in chapter 3, verse 1, just two verses later, he says, therefore, holy brethren, partakers of a heavenly calling, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession. So he's already brought it up a couple times, but he hasn't expanded on it. He hasn't explained what that means. He's just been getting himself ready. And more than that, each of these chapters in different ways have laid the foundation for this idea. Chapter 1, we had Jesus being the Son of God. Chapter 2, we had Jesus as a human. And chapter 3, we had Jesus being faithful. And chapter 4 as well. Now, all of those laid the foundation for Jesus being a great high priest. Now, here's the way that works. If we're going to have someone who's going to go between us and God, we're going to need someone who is both on our side and on God's side. So he's showing us here he's on our side and he's a human. He's 100% human. He knows everything that humans go through. And he's on God's side. He's the Son of God. So he's the perfect one to be there talking to God. And then if you're going to have a high priest who your salvation depends on, he better be faithful. He better be someone who actually does his job. And he showed us in chapter 3 and 4, Jesus was completely faithful in what he did. He did his job perfectly to take care of those sins. And so these four chapters leading up to chapter 5 have been laying this foundation of Jesus' character, who Jesus is, so that now he can say, Jesus is a great high priest, and we see the evidence for what makes him great. But now in the rest of chapter 4 and in chapter 5, he's going to give us further evidence to show us how he fits that role. In verse 14, he says, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. What do you guys think this idea of passing through the heavens means? Any thoughts on that? What does it mean he's passed through the heavens?
He's been there before he came here.
What's that?
He had been there before he came here.
That's a good point. Yes, he was in heaven, and now he's on earth. And then after he was on earth, he went back up into heaven. So we definitely have this man who's gone back and forth between heaven and earth. Now, that's pretty unique. We don't have many people who are able to make this transition back and forth. Now, why would that be important as far as a priest? Yes?
It almost seems to be like going through the veil in the tabernacle or in the temple where it's this barrier that you can't cross, but Jesus has done that, and you can't go to heaven to God's presence or anything, but he has.
Very good. You think of that image of the priest going through that veil, and it's the same kind of idea of Jesus going into God's presence and coming back, this idea of being able to go from us to God. And so that's exactly what he's showing here. Here's Jesus on earth, then he goes up into heaven. That's here he's with humanity, then he's with God. He's able to make that transition. Now there's another phrase in here. In the next part of the verse, he says, Jesus, the Son of God. Now, that's just referring to Jesus, but you notice he uses both names, Jesus and the Son of God. Now, that, I believe, is significant. And because the reason I think it's significant is because in chapter 1, he exclusively used the name the Son to refer to Jesus. Then in chapter 2, he started using the name Jesus. Whenever he was talking about Jesus as the exalted Savior, he talks about him as the Son. Whenever he wants to talk about Jesus on earth, he talks about him as Jesus. And so here he's tying those two names together. He's showing when Jesus was on earth, here's Jesus, a human. He's up in heaven. He's the Son of God. Yes?
Well, the high priest could only enter this holy of holies, holy places once per year. Christ is there every day of the year.
That's a good point. And what he's actually going to show later on in the book is how the high priest had to do it over and over and over. Jesus just did it once. With one sacrifice, he was able to go before God, and it's done. And that was a big difference between the power of Jesus' sacrifice and the priest's sacrifices. Yeah, good point. So here he shows Jesus is both a human and he's God. That makes him the perfect person to be that go-between between us on earth and God in heaven. Now, in the next verse, in verse 15, he says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." This verse is very familiar because here he's referencing us back to chapter 2. He's reteaching the same concept that he established in chapter 2. Jesus came down to earth. He lived just like us. He went through all of the same things that we went through. And so he's able to sympathize with what we're going through today. He's able to understand our lives today. He's trying to review that and reference that again and say, remember what I taught you about who Jesus is as a man. And then the next verse, verse 16. He says, in verse 16, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need." Usually the way he's arranged his book is as the writer's been setting out these arguments, he'll go through and he'll give all of his logical arguments, and then he'll end that section with, here's the application. Now, for whatever reason, in this section, he flip-flops that. He starts with the application. Here's what I want you to learn. Here's what I want you to be practicing and take home from this. And then in chapter 5, he's going to go through all the evidences to convince us that that's the case. But here's the... Go ahead, Brene.
I take it the reason that it's divided is because men way afterwards had chapter divisions.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes in Hebrews that kind of throws us off because sometimes the chapter divisions aren't really between sections like we'd like. And this is definitely one of those cases. Chapter 4 just runs right into chapter 5. He's talking about the exact same thing. Yeah. So draw near to the throne of grace. The throne of grace is the idea of Jesus' throne. That Jesus is sitting at the right hand of God in heaven. He's seated there. And Jesus' reign is this reign characterized by grace. So we are drawing near to Jesus, to his throne, which is characterized by grace and mercy. And because he's of who he is, because of the high priest that he is, that's why we can draw near to this throne of grace. Now, the way we need to be drawing near to it is, he says, with boldness, or some translations will say, with confidence. Now, that's kind of a puzzling thing, especially when he's talking to this Jewish audience. how would people normally think of drawing near to God? Would it be with boldness and confidence, or how would you typically think of drawing near to God?
Meekly.
What's that?
Meek.
Meekly, yes, absolutely.
Fear.
Fear, yes. You
would
think
it be
about.
In prayer?
Yes.
Prayer?
In prayer, yes.
Would be the how we.
That is the avenue.
How we communicate.
Yes. But you think about throughout the Old Testament, the fear that the people had to have of God, of who he was. You think of all the people who were struck dead, as we talked about throughout the book of Numbers. It wasn't just this trivial thing to walk into God's presence. There was this fear there. And now he's saying, you can walk boldly right up to the throne of Jesus. Wow. You remember in the book of Esther? Here we're not with the Jews, but here we're talking about other kings, earthly kings. You remember how Esther came before King Ahasuerus in that book? She was scared to death. If he didn't so much as lift his scepter, she would be killed. It was a scary thing to come before the king's throne. But here the writer turns it all upside down, and he says, we can walk right up to Jesus' throne with boldness and confidence because he reigns with grace and mercy. That's the kind of king that we serve. Now, we talked last time about the fear that we do need to have. We do need to have a healthy fear of God. But that we need to have, as he's showing here, a confidence that when we're having challenges, we turn to Jesus. We turn to God. He will help us in those challenges. We don't need to be scared to go before God to say, I'm having trouble. I'm struggling. Jesus reigns on our throne of grace, and he wants to help us. And then he gives us this imagery here when he talks about drawing near to the throne of grace so that we can receive mercy. When you put it in the perspective of these Hebrews, he's really saying, you're going the wrong way. Here are the readers, and here's Jesus. And the readers started out, as they became Christians, they were following Jesus. Things were going pretty well. But then, as we've talked about, things got difficult. They went through trials and challenges, temptations and persecutions. And so, they're suddenly going the other way. They're saying, I want to give up. I want to quit. Following Jesus is not working out well for me. And here the author's saying, you're turning the wrong way. When you go through those trials and those temptations, that should cause you to go even more towards Jesus. And the reason it should cause us to go even more towards Jesus is because Jesus is the one who can help us. He's the one who can give us help in time of need. So when we go through these challenges and we go through these temptations and life is difficult, rather than those sins and those things causing us to turn away from God, he's saying it should draw us closer to God. Because God's the one who can help. Jesus is the one who can help us in those times of need. All right, and that brings us to chapter 5. In chapter 5, let's read the first few verses and then let's kind of see the structure that he's laying out here. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. All right. Well, the way he's going to lay out this book, this chapter 5, is very, very organized. It's one of the great things about the Hebrew writer is he has a very organized, logical way of writing it. He's going to go through and he's going to point out three things that a priest needs to have, three attributes of a great priest. And then he's going to go back through those three things in reverse order and show how Jesus fulfilled each of these three aspects. So the first one is he must offer sacrifices to God. That we talked about that's what a priest does. He goes and he offers sacrifices. He's chosen from among men, as he says in verse 1, for every high priest chosen from among men is to act on behalf of men. So the priest must be chosen from people. We don't have an angel doing that for us. We don't have some other creature or something. If they're going to be a go-between between man and God, it's first thing that's important is they have to be a human. Then that human goes before God. And as that human goes before God, that human offers some kind of a sacrifice. Now here he uses the phrase gifts and sacrifices. It could be that he's talking about the two different kinds of sacrifices in the old law. You had the free will offerings and then the ones that were required. It may be that he's trying to point out both of those, that the high priest is responsible for making these offerings before God. So here one of the main things that the priest does, the most important thing, is he's got to go before God and offer that sacrifice so that we can have forgiveness. If he's not going to offer the sacrifice, there's no point to a high priest. Okay, the next one that's very important is he must be sympathetic. Now, why would a high priest need to be sympathetic? Can anyone think of a reason? Why would he need to have sympathy for people if he's a high priest?
He needs to understand what they're going through.
He needs to understand what they're going through, absolutely. If he's going to be able to represent them to the people, represent the people to God, he's going to have to be on the side of the people. He's going to have to understand that, yeah, they sin, they go through hard times. And so when he goes before God, it's in this understanding way that he's doing it on behalf of those people. Now, here's how that plays out with an Old Testament priest. He needs to be in the same position as his people. In verse 2, he says, he can deal gently with the ignorant and the wayward, since he himself is beset with weaknesses. He goes through this exact same challenges that everybody else in Israel goes through. He is tempted in the same kinds of ways. He knows what it's like to be tempted. And so when he goes before God, he's going 100% with the knowledge of humanity. He has all of those same weaknesses that humans have. And in fact, he says here in verse 2, he can deal, in verse 3, because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. So, here he's saying the high priest would not only offer sacrifices for the people, but he'd even have to offer sacrifices for himself because he too was a sinner. Now let's flip back. I want to flip back to Leviticus real quick and just see how prominent that actually was. In Leviticus chapter 16, Moses actually makes a pretty big point on that. Chapter 16, Moses describes the Day of Atonement and what the high priest would have to do as he goes before God. And we're going to see throughout this, he keeps mentioning, offers a sacrifice for the people and for himself. Verse 6, then Aaron shall offer the bull for the sin offering, which is for himself, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household. Then, in verse 11, then Aaron shall offer the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his household. And he shall slaughter the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself. And then all the way down in verse 17, when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place, no one shall be in the tent of meeting until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself and for his household and for all the assembly of Israel. This was a major point for the Israelites. They had to see that the high priest was on the exact same playing field as they were. Yes, Renee?
And also seeing there's order specific. He might use the word and, but it's always he has to do himself first, I guess, because he can't atone for us, or the Hebrew nation, and approach God if he has that sin, so he has to do himself first.
That is possible. Yeah, I'd have to look at that. That may be true that it was him going before God. He needed to cleanse himself for that as well. Yeah. So here's this idea that he goes through all the same challenges as humanity. Now, we're going to start seeing a difference here between Jesus and the earthly high priests. Jesus didn't have any sin, but he did have all of the same weaknesses that we as humanity have. He did have all the same temptations. And so even though he wasn't offering a sacrifice for himself, he was dealing with all of those temptations that we deal with. And then the third point that the author makes.
Real quick, brother.
Yes.
It seems like there's a really practical point here I'd like to think about, and that is that gentleness is connected to an understanding of our own weakness. So when we understand the challenges of living life, the difficulties of it, it changes the way that we interact with others. The person who's not gentle in their interaction with others probably needs to first start in thinking about their own weaknesses.
Very good. Yeah. Okay, the third point here. A high priest must be appointed by God. Now, the way he shows this is by going back to Aaron. He says in verse 4, "And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was." He says, he uses the word honor here. This being a priest was this great honor, but it's not something that I point myself to. I don't campaign for it. There's no election that people vote me into that position. It's something where God chooses to make me that priest. And he gives the example of Aaron being appointed by God. Now, the reason he has to go all the way back to Aaron is probably because the people were not following this. When you get to the New Testament times, the priests were not appointed by God. In fact, at the time of this writing, the priests were probably being appointed by Rome, and it was more of a political office. And so they had taken this thing completely in the wrong direction. But here the Hebrew writer takes it back to the beginning, the way it started out, where Aaron was appointed by God. And in the same way, Jesus is going to be appointed by God. Now, that leads us into talking about Jesus. So he's shown us these three ways, three things that make a great high priest. If we're going to have a high priest, these are some qualifications that he's going to have. Now, he's going to go back through these in reverse order and show us how Jesus fulfills each one of these. To start with, he's going to show us that God appointed Jesus as our high priest. And he's going to show that by going to Old Testament prophecies that explain God saying Jesus is the priest. He's going to show us that from two prophecies. The first one is Psalm 2. Let's read verse 5. "So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, 'You are my son, today I've begotten you.'" That's from Hebrews chapter 5, verse 5. He's quoting Psalm 2. Now, there's some puzzling things about this. The first puzzling thing is that this prophecy doesn't say anything about priests. It says, "You are my son, today I've begotten you." So what is the writer doing here? What is he trying to say about Jesus being a priest from a text that says nothing about priests? Well, he connects it to the next passage, and that's going to kind of be the answer. But let's look at this. He's building on a quotation that he had back in chapter 1. This exact same verse was quoted back in chapter 1. And in chapter 1, it was used to show us how Jesus is greater than angels. Jesus is, in fact, God's son. And so he was showing us in chapter 1, here's God speaking to the Messiah and saying, "You are my son." So that proves that the Messiah, Jesus, was in fact God's son. Now he's referencing it again to kind of bring that back into our minds. He's already convinced us of that point that Jesus is God's son, and he used this passage to do that. Here he's showing us God. This is a passage where God speaks to the Messiah. And the reason I believe he needs to use this passage is because the phrasing is so similar between this and the next passage that he's going to quote. Verse 6, he says, "As he says also in another place, 'You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek.'" So in Psalm 2, he says, you are my son. In the next quotation, he says, you are a priest forever. So let's look at this next quotation and see how these connect to each other. The next one is from Psalm 110. And in Psalm 110, God again is talking to the Messiah. This is a great messianic psalm in that it's a psalm where it's describing the ideal Israelite king. But it describes the king in such incredible terms that no earthly king ever lived up to this. And in fact, it was most likely, and definitely from what the Hebrew writer is explaining here, it was prophesying of the Messiah. So it was a prophetic psalm talking about the Messiah. And in that, as God's speaking to the Messiah, he says, you are a priest. Now, the thing that the Hebrew writer did was he already showed us a passage that we knew and understood, a passage that he had already explained. We agreed that Psalm 2 meant God was saying to the Messiah, you are my son. And now the Hebrew writer is trying to connect that with this passage and saying, if you agree with Psalm 2, then you have to agree with Psalm 110. It's the same phrasing. It's yet another psalm of God talking to the Messiah. They're so similar, you can't accept one without the other. And therefore, Jesus is also a priest. He was appointed by God as a priest, as we see in this psalm. The logic of the way he connects it is really, it's a beautiful organization the way he puts that together. And then one other point about this is he mentions Melchizedek. He says, after the order of Melchizedek. That's going to be a big point coming up here. In the next couple chapters, he's going to develop that a lot further of who is Melchizedek, why is Jesus compared to him, what does that mean about his priesthood. For now, he's just going to leave that. He's just putting that on the table. You can think about that, but we're going to develop that one a little bit later on. For right now, let's just talk about Jesus as a priest. So Jesus was a priest who was appointed by God, and he endured all the challenges of humanity. He is the ideal sympathetic high priest because he endured everything that we endure. Well, how did he do that? How did Jesus experience the same kinds of things that we experience? He says in verse 7, let's read verse 7. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned to be obedient through what he suffered. Well, at the beginning of that verse is something that's a little bit phrased differently. He says, in the days of his flesh. What does that mean, in the days of his flesh? Any ideas on that?
The human side of him.
Yes, with us, we don't have to talk like that. We don't have to say, oh, you remember back when I was a human? For Jesus, there has to be a distinction there, because there's at one point that he had flesh and blood, and now he's up in heaven. So he's having to say, you remember back when Jesus was a human? That's the part I want to talk about now. And to do that, he takes us back to Gethsemane. He says here, with loud cries and tears, verse 7, he says, offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. So the image that he's giving us is he's saying, let's go back to Gethsemane and remember what Jesus did there. And remember Jesus there in the garden as he prays to God. Here's the loud cries and the tears and everything to a God who had the ability to save him from death. Now, what were the things that Jesus prayed for in Gethsemane? Does anyone remember? Let this cup pass from me. So that was the first thing. He was saying, let this cup pass from me. If it's possible, please let this cup pass from me. But then what was the caveat on that?
If it's your will.
If it's your will. Your will be done. Whatever your will is, your will be done. This is what I want, but your will be done, God. Now, the Hebrew writer says, his prayer was answered. So the question is, was his prayer answered? Was that prayer at Gethsemane answered? How was it answered? Any thoughts on that?
Silence.
God's will was done. Yes. Jesus said, let this cup pass from me, but if that's not your will be done. God's will was done. Man's will wasn't done. Satan's will wasn't done. In the end, it was God's will that was done as Jesus offered up that great sacrifice for everyone and then was resurrected. God's will was accomplished. So we look at that prayer and we might think, oh, he wanted this so much. He wanted it to pass from him and it didn't get answered. God said no. Oh. The Hebrew writer looks at that and says, God heard that prayer. He answered that prayer because Jesus was praying, your will be done. That's an interesting take on prayer. And so the Hebrew writer is showing us here, Jesus was a human. Jesus experienced all of the challenges that we have. You know, when we have times where we pray to God and we say, God, I really want this to happen. But, you know, your will be done. And we're so stressed out about that. Jesus experienced all of that stress and all of that pain that we go through. And then in the next verse, he learned obedience through that. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. So this one's kind of a challenge. Here he is the Son of God, and yet he learned obedience. You don't think of the Son of God learning obedience. Does that mean that he didn't have obedience before? It seems kind of strange. Well, here's what it seems like he's doing. He didn't want to suffer. Here's Jesus at Gethsemane. He didn't want to suffer, but in the end, he did it anyway. In the end, he was obedient. So what was it that he learned from that? He learned the experience of having to obey. The experience of, it's hard to obey, I don't want to do it, but I do it anyway. And because of that, he is able to help us. When we go through those hard times, when I say, Jesus, I'm struggling here. I know what I need to do, but I don't want to do it. Jesus says, I know exactly what you're talking about. I was right there. I know what that feels like when you don't want to do the right thing, but you do it anyway, and it's hard. Jesus learned what that was like. Yes?
And isn't that why God answers prayer when we do what he wants?
Good point. Yes, he even mentions here he was heard because of his reverence. Absolutely. Okay, and then the last one here. Jesus is the source of salvation. A high priest has to go and offer a sacrifice. Jesus certainly did that. Jesus offered the ultimate sacrifice. He says here in verse 9, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a priest after the order of Melchizedek. He was made perfect. Maybe that was through his suffering, or maybe it was through him being exalted afterwards, but in some way he is the perfect high priest who offers that eternal salvation to all of us. And now, there's a condition on that. We receive that eternal salvation, but we have to obey. The salvation to all who obey him, to all who choose to follow him, he gives that salvation. Now, those were his arguments. He was showing here through all of this, Jesus is the perfect high priest. He is a great high priest. He fulfills all of the requirements of what we would want in a high priest. And so here's the application. As he said through this chapter, Jesus is perfectly qualified to go before God on our behalf. He was the one who passed from earth to heaven. He is both man and God. He's perfectly qualified to be a high priest. And he wants to help us. He's been there on earth. He's suffered what we've suffered. He's on our side. And so he can give us grace and mercy. That's what he said back at the end of chapter 4. He can give us grace and mercy in our time of need. And so for us, we need to draw near to that throne of grace. When we're going through challenges and things are hard, we need to pray to God. He will help us because Jesus understands. He knows what we're going through, and he wants to help us with those challenges. He's on our side. And so for all of us, let's draw near to that throne of grace. Next week, we will finish up chapter 5 and begin chapter 6.